Lizzie O'Leary, and this is your Marketplace Weekend podcast for the weekend of July 25th, 2014. Maybe you know about the butterfly effect. The theory says that when a butterfly flaps its wings in one part of the world, it can cause a hurricane in another. It's a key principle in chaos theory. But it also explains so much of life and how unintended consequences can change our paths. Something that even 6 years after the financial crisis, we can all still feel. A smaller retirement account, a kid living in a spare bedroom, a job you never thought you'd lose or have to take. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend. This show is all about consequences and how they shape people's lives. Our show is always a conversation, so come talk to us online at marketplaceweekend.org or on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. But first, here's your economic week in 30 seconds.
Walmart announced today that its U.S. CEO Bill Simon is leaving the company, but he's not leaving empty-handed. Mr. Simon will receive a total of $9.17 million.
General Motors is announcing six new recalls covering 717,000 vehicles.
Herbalife shares hitting a fresh all-time high today as Bill Ackman laid out his case against the company, calling it the most important presentation of his career.
A U.S. appeals court threw out a federal regulation that implements key subsidies that are vital to President Obama's health care reform, also known as Obamacare.
Let's dig a little more into that last story. Maybe you thought Obamacare was settled law after the Supreme Court upheld key parts of it. Well, it was back in federal court this week with two conflicting rulings about its future. We wanted to understand what happens next, so we brought in Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein. He covers healthcare for us and joins me now. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Lizzie.
So tell me about these two federal rulings and what effect they have on the Affordable Care Act.
On its face, it's fairly confusing because you have these two conflicting rulings. One court said that the only people who are eligible to receive federal subsidies for health care are people who live in states that have set up their own exchanges. But two-thirds of the states in the country, Lizzie, have not set up their own exchanges and are having the federal government run those exchanges. And according to one court, if you live in a state with a federal exchange, then you are not eligible for those subsidies. That would affect about 4.5 million people. So the other court ruled, though, that anyone is eligible for these subsidies, whether the state is running the exchange or the federal government's running the exchange. So we're going to sort of see how this plays out. It's probably going to take about a year.
So we're going to watch that as it moves through the court system. And then we're also just a few months away from the next enrollment period. We don't really know, right, if people are going to be able to get subsidies.
Well, I think it's pretty clear, at least for 2015, enrollment begins November 15th this year. For 2015, everybody's expecting that these people will be, in fact, eligible for subsidies regardless of the state that you live in. So if you're out there listening to this right now and you live in a state that has a federal exchange running the operation there, then it's pretty safe bet that you will be able to get a subsidy.
If the one ruling that essentially says no subsidies for federal exchanges keeps going, if that moves up, would that really be a death knell for the ACA?
That's a really good question, Lizzie. I think that this is what a lot of experts sort of predict would happen. If all of a sudden you have like two-thirds of the population in the exchanges not being eligible to get subsidies, which is about $4,250 on average, it's a lot of money. The thinking is that all of the healthy people would basically flee the exchanges, leaving a bunch of sick people in the exchanges, and that would just drive up costs. And people in healthcare policy like to call that a death spiral. So that's a real concern. However, you've got to remember that the people here who are getting subsidies, they're sort of middle-class people, and they've got a lot of clout. I mean, a family of four that's eligible for a subsidy is making nearly $100,000 a year. So there's some thinking that there'd be a lot of political pressure, both at the federal level and the state level, to try to get some traction, to find some sort of resolution one way or another. And some experts have said it could be as easy as states just opening a small office and then subcontracting immediately with the federal government to run the exchange, and it wouldn't really be a big change. So there's a lot of speculation, there are a lot of questions, but there's certainly a path to see how, even if this ruling stands that only certain people are eligible for subsidies, there's a pretty clear and straightforward workaround.
Dan Gorenstein, who covers healthcare for us, thank you so much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
We wanted to talk a little bit more about healthcare and some other economic issues. Plus, it's the weekend. So let's have brunch. So we're here having some brunch at the Cornerstone Tavern on 2nd Avenue in New York City, and I've got with me Lynette Lopez from Business Insider. Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. And Ben Walsh from Reuters. Hi, Ben.
Hi.
So I want to start with healthcare. We had a reporter talking about some of the Affordable Care Act stuff, and Ben, I know you've been thinking about kind of how healthcare fits into our economy and really what happens with the Affordable Care Act, how that impacts kind of where our economy goes from here.
Yeah, so the Affordable Care Act and all the legal decisions around it are obviously massive politically, but economically, healthcare is a huge part of America. It's 18% of our gross domestic product, and then because in the U.S., your healthcare is tied to your job, it affects a much larger portion of the economy. And so how the government can regulate that is going to really impact how Americans work, where they work, and how they decide to carry out their lives, which has huge economic impacts.
And these are kind of these moments where policy writ large really does intersect with how you live your life, how you get up and go to work. Lynette, you, I know, have been thinking about the idea of sort of policy decisions and how we see them play out. And that's one where I think we feel it.
Americans have a very interesting idea of what exactly public good is and what the government should take care of and what the government shouldn't take care of. And that's really the battlefield that we're fighting on right now. Americans that can't be healthy and can't work are always going to be on the lower end of society. If we want to pull all Americans up, we have to make sure that they have access to the way they can be physically strongest and get to work and be participating members of this economy.
This is an interesting question, though, this inequality question, this idea of inequality within the United States. Obviously, this has been a very big issue, both politically, economically. And there is a fascinating op-ed that was written this week about inequality in the U.S. and then inequality overall. Ben, I want you to sketch it out for me. This comes from Tyler Cowen. Tell us who he is and why this matters.
Sure. So he is an economics professor at George Mason University, and he wrote an op-ed that, as you mentioned, talked about global inequality. And it's based on research done by Branko Milanovic, who's at the World Bank. And
who's also a really good tweeter, I just
want to
say.
He's excellent on Twitter. If you like soccer, or as the rest of the world calls it, football, he's actually a great combination.
Says the guy who went to the World Cup.
That's right. And so what this research shows is that basically, while we all know that the American middle class has been, for the last 20 years or so, not experiencing the same economic income gains that upper-class Americans have, it basically puts that into a global perspective and says, well, actually, the global middle class has been seeing really big gains in incomes over the last 20 or 30 years. The problem with that is that if you put the American middle class onto the global spectrum, they're actually the upper class of the world.
So it's a sort of we lose, if you're thinking about the U.S., everybody else gains. That's a hard thing, I think, for Americans maybe to wrap their heads around.
It is a hard thing for Americans to wrap their heads around, because what we can do as Americans getting frustrated about the international global economy and what that's doing, it's almost a useless thought. We can only make ourselves as awesome as we can possibly be.
But at the same time, it's sort of like, well, do we need to be thinking about America first, or should we be thinking about a global economy where we're thinking about overall harmony?
Right, and that's really Cowen's point, is he says, you know, there's been a huge focus on inequality within the developed world, and he's trying to broaden the perspective and say, well, shouldn't we actually care and laud the fact that over the last 20 years there's been huge global growth in the middle class? It just hasn't been in the specific countries that have those ideals. And so the counterpoint to that, which was really...
Lynette's shaking her head, though, man.
Really smart point, though, which I sympathize a lot with, made by Ryan Avent in The Economist, was voters in developed economies aren't going to be content with essentially running their economies as a charity project for people in other countries.
That's exactly my point. I think that, you know, as Americans, And it's really cute for a professor to say, you know, the middle class of America should be thanking their lucky stars that they live here and compare themselves to the developing world where people are finally getting running water. Fine. That's true. But in America, everything is relative. And if people can't feed their families, even though they have a television in their living room, they still can't feed their families.
I'm going to shift us to a lighter topic. Lynette, you wrote some rules.
I did. I
had to. For gentlemen dressing themselves.
Or rather,
things they should take out of their closet and burn.
You should not, as an adult, be wearing graphic tees. You should not, as an adult, be wearing sunglasses that make you look like RoboCop. You should not have cut-off sleeveless shirts that you wear around in the street.
I want you to know our producer's over there checking on his shirt.
Sleeves are not cut.
It's got a pattern. And what is that, Chicago Blackhawks t-shirt? What do we got in there?
Yeah, it looks like Blackhawks.
That's okay. I'll give you sports.
All right,
I'll give
sports.
You sports.
Sports.
I do not abide.
Just don't wear actual replica jerseys. That's bad.
I do not abide khaki cargo shorts or cargo shorts of any kind.
Current serving military members are allowed to wear cargo pants in the field of battle.
In the field of battle. It better be a life or death situation. Right. And so
they need cargo.
They need cargo.
Unless you have every single one of those pockets stuffed, I see no reason. Swim trunks that go down past your knees, gentlemen. You look like you're drowning in them.
That's, again, the Jack Johnson problem.
Awful.
I await the listener letters we are going to get about your fashion tips.
Oh, the comments that I've received are just unreal.
Lynette Lopez, Ben Walsh, thank you guys very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up next on Marketplace Weekend, speaking of unintended consequences, yeah, sure, you can stay at my place till you get back on your feet. Oh my God, get out of my apartment! Jill Schlesinger gives us a few tough love lessons about boomerang kids.
When you have a family member or even a friend in need, it can be hard to draw those boundaries.
Stick around. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. In this part of the show, we're going to talk about one of the unexpected consequences of the recession, and that still hits a lot of families. It's that son, daughter, maybe it's a parent, who moved back into your house because they can't make it on their own right now. People sometimes call them boomerangs. As with a lot of things involving family and money, these situations can be really messy. And to walk us through them, we've got Jill Schlesinger. She's a CBS News business analyst. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Great to be with you.
Let's talk about what people call boomerang kids, or I guess boomerang relatives, right? People who end up maybe not in the home that they thought they would. This is a phenomenon that seems to be happening a fair amount in our economy these days.
Yeah, it absolutely has become not just an outsized recessionary economic factor. It just seems that more and more people, multi-generational families living together, sometimes out of economic necessity, sometimes because maybe parents are making it really easy for kids to come home. Back in my day, Lizzie, no one wanted to go home. We were all excited to get our feet out the door. But I talk to a lot of kids these days, and they're pretty happy being home with their folks.
I want to play some sound from someone in our sort of Marketplace Weekend community. This is Pat in Riverside, whose son has been living with her for a little while, maybe almost 2 years now. And she's, you can hear it in her voice how she feels about it. Let's listen.
Hi. I'm really irritated with my grown son. He's moved back in. He doesn't clean up after himself. Yes, he has financial difficulties, as many people in this economy. However, at this point, he's working my last nerve that I had saved for so many, including the IRS. And I really need him to leave now. I would like to tell my son that I know he will be very successful, and he's got a lot of great attributes, but staying here with me isn't one of them. He's got to go. Goodbye.
So, Jill, there is a lot of love in that voice, but man, there is frustration too. How do you start that conversation of, I love you, but it is time to go?
I have to say that that's probably about the worst way to start a conversation with anyone you love, whether it's you're related to that person or you're actually in love with that person. Look, it's really tough to have the conversation when you haven't had the conversation on the come in, meaning that the best way to go back in time, I know we can't do it today, but to go back in time to for Pat's situation would be before her son moved back in, that they would sit down and she would say, honey, I love you. So let's talk about the parameters under which we think this is going to work best. Here's my expectation of you. I'm going to, you know, I want you to clean up after yourself. You got to do the dishes, da, 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 da. And then maybe the son says, okay, mom, I don't want you meddling in my affairs. I don't have a curfew anymore because I'm 22 years old or 25 years old, but there's an agreement. The problem is when it's been loosey-goosey and the kids come back in and then you're in this situation and you want the kids gone. So now we're in a situation where she's going to have a difficult conversation. It is probably going to be more difficult to have this conversation with her son than maybe that other talk she might have had when he was 13 years old. And you start by, you literally have to start by saying, look, we need to come to an agreement about when we're targeting you leaving.
There is another phenomenon that is happening in our economy where we're not just talking about kids maybe in their 20s or their 30s, but people who are in their 50s or their 60s who have been unemployed find it very hard to get back into the economy, into the labor force, and maybe are living with their parents who are in their 70s or their 80s. What advice do you have for someone who sees themselves in that situation? That's a very unexpected place to be.
It sure is, and becoming more and more common. Now, this is a little bit more difficult, and I want to bring this up because if you have siblings and your aging parents, ultimately you're probably going to survive them, what's happening with that house? How is that going to be fair in the aftermath of an estate getting settled? What kind of steps are we taking today to make sure that your siblings don't kick you out? What should the parents do in their own estate plan to compensate the other siblings who aren't going to get this big asset? And so all of this sounds kind of macabre, but if you have conversations ahead of time, the great thing is you don't have to deal with this when you're really full of grief in the aftermath of a death.
All of these things sound like the key here is communication and clear expectations.
I think communication and expectations. I think what's very difficult is that when you have a family member or even a friend in need, it can be hard to draw those boundaries. But I urge you to try to have these tough conversations, because if you don't, as these problems, they sort of escalate. And I tell you that it just gets harder and harder. I mean, listening to Pat's voice, you know, it sounds like she's going to pull her hair out.
You are joining us from London, and there are some interesting numbers in Europe where one statistic says 50% of young adult children in the EU are either living with their parents or moving back home with them. Any thoughts about why it's more common there than we see in the U.S. and anything we can learn from, either in a good way or as a cautionary tale?
It's funny you should say that, because I was with somebody who is in that situation this week. First of all, at least in London, which is where I'm talking to you from, the problem about getting housing is insane. London property values have skyrocketed since the recession, and young people are really having a tough time being able to live out on their own. So they are almost expected to come back home. You know, look, everyone does what they have to do for their family members. I understand that. I just think that as we look at this situation, it can be really a positive thing. It can be a symbiotic, wonderful relationship, as long as you are clear about what your expectations are and that both sides really give and take. You know, it's like any other relationship. It's a little bit harder because, you know, your parents know how to push your buttons. I'm sorry.
Jill Schlesinger is a CBS News business analyst and the host of Jill on Money. Thanks a lot, Jill.
great to be with you.
The cost of childcare in America has nearly doubled in the past 25 years. So for next week, we want to know, how do you make it work? Does a family member watch your kids? Do you pay for daycare? Tell us about your childcare sacrifices and solutions. Visit our website, marketplaceweekend.org, or talk to us on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. Money is a constant in our world, almost no matter what. But sometimes, violence and chaos make things pretty much grind to a halt. We wanted to know, on a very basic level, how war zone households get what they need when commerce has all but stopped. To help give us some insight, the BBC's Rushdie Abu Alouf joins us from the Gaza Strip, where a battle is being waged between Israel and Hamas militants. Rushdie, thanks for being here.
Yes, welcome.
Can you tell me, is there any commerce or business happening in Gaza right now?
No, most of the businesses are shut, except few bakeries is open and some of the clinics to treat those who got injured in the conflict. The main market for fruit and vegetables open normally in the day hours between like 10 o'clock in the morning until like 4 in the afternoon. Other than that, everything is shut in Gaza.
When we think about a war zone, you know, business and commerce isn't the first thing we think about, but you have so many kids and families there. How are people managing to get the kinds of supplies that they need for daily life?
We are talking, according to the UN, about more than 100,000 people are taking UN schools as shelters. They flee from the fighting areas next to the border in different areas in Gaza Strip. Those people, they feed them, they bring them food and medicine and mattresses, everything they need. We are not talking about gun battles in every single street. We are talking about Israeli ground operations, still limited operations. So when there is a little bit of quiet, people take the opportunity and go buy food and to buy medicine. And also we have to know that the UN is providing food and medicine for about 900,000 people.
So they're able to get a lot of what they need from the UN. Contrast what normal looks like in Gaza when there is not this kind of military activity going on. What does normal business and commerce look like?
Well, the situation in general, even before this current Israeli offensive or the current cycle of violence, was very bad. Gaza was under a tough blockade for the last 7 years, and most of the essential and basic needs for the people, like electricity, clean water, are not there. So the business was bad anyway before the current crisis, but at least the people who used to get like 8 hours electricity every day, now since like 48 hours, none of the places in Gaza, across Gaza Strip, they have any electricity or any power. And when there is no electricity, there is no water.
Gaza has had an active black market, and there are other ways in which people get supplies and manage to fund what they are doing. When you look into the future, what are the sources that we potentially see for commerce to start flowing again?
Well, without a political solution that will put end for all the hostilities across the border from Gaza and from Israel, no way for this nation to survive. All of the observers and all of the human rights organizations who are working closely in Gaza believe that without having a comprehensive agreement or deal, the situation will be like deteriorating every day.
Rushdie Abu Alouf with the BBC in Gaza City. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Not at all.
Now we have a story about the consequences of expanding Chinese wealth. Maybe you like to scan real estate websites like Zillow to look at the listings. Well, now Zillow is translating U.S. listings into Mandarin for potential Chinese buyers. Last year alone, Chinese buyers bought $11 billion worth of real estate in the U.S.
We wanted to put this buying boom in context, so we took a trip out to Brooklyn to meet a Mandarin-speaking realtor.
My name is Allie Clark. I'm an agent at Corcoran Real Estate.
Clark is standing outside a brick building that's been redone with big windows, pretty copper trim, and 8 apartments for sale, each one about $500,000.
Where are we? We are at 1192 Bedford Avenue. So this is the nexus of Clinton Hill, Bed-Stuy, and fairly close to Williamsburg.
You have foreign interest in this building?
I do. I'm actually, two of my buyers from Taiwan are in contract for two of the apartments here. There's usually a big rush before college. So around summertime is really when they start looking for apartments, and a lot of them look for apartments for the kids to live in before they go to school. So my mother actually did the same for me when I went to NYU long time ago. But so I think there, even though this might be seem like a new trend, it's actually been happening for a really long time.
What's that like? I mean, this is, you know, a burgeoning market. I know there's a lot of money, a lot of interest in folks both from mainland China and from Taiwan who are investing in real estate in the States and certainly in New York.
It's actually, it's really easy doing business with them because they usually know exactly what they want, and they usually are ready. They're ready to go. When they come here, they know what they want, and you show them 5-6 places, and then they pick one, and then it's as an agent, I mean, it's good, you know.
Are they buying in cash?
Usually, yes. There are a few programs that offer mortgages to foreign buyers, but most of them buy with cash, yes.
When you look at overseas investors, and particularly Chinese investors, what are they willing to pay?
Oh, it really varies widely. I think the initial wave where, you know, a lot of people like to buy. I mean, a couple years ago, it might have been the trophy apartment where you have people buying on 57th Street in Manhattan, spending $30 million. But I think now, you know, I think usually, I think on average, it's about $1 million for people who, you know, who have kids coming, and, you know, I would say that's a good number.
Having had this be a part of your experience, do you think that helps you connect with clients?
Oh, definitely. I think so. Just because I had the exact same experience of moving here to go to college, and then I've stayed here, so I know, you know, I have a good amount of experience. And most, I've lived all over New York. I've lived in Manhattan, you know, when East Village was, you know, you could get a studio for $600. So I feel like I can tell the parents with confidence that, you know, which neighborhoods their kids are going to be okay. And you know, a lot of them still sort of have an idea that they want to make sure that the kids are safe.
Allie Clark, thank you so much.
Thank you.
New York, of course, is just one real estate market. We also talked to Jed Kolko, the chief economist for the real estate website Trulia. He says foreign buyers, especially Chinese buyers, are attracted to the U.S. market because places like Canada have just gotten too expensive.
And that had been a traditional destination for a lot of Chinese investment in North American real estate. Compared to Canada, the U.S. looks relatively affordable. Prices plunged after the housing bubble burst, even though prices have rebounded, particularly in California and other West Coast markets popular with Chinese investors. Prices still look more in line with long-term fundamentals than they did during the bubble or than they do in Canada.
There are stories here in New York, a woman in Hong Kong who paid more than $6 million for a 2-bedroom apartment here for her daughter so that she could go to school in New York. Her daughter is now 2 years old. What does this tell you about the kinds of investments you are seeing from folks in the Mandarin-speaking world?
I think it's important to remember that there are lots of different kinds of buyers of U.S. real estate. Some people are looking to come to the U.S. to live. Others may be looking for a second home that they live in part-time. Some might be looking for investments to rent it out. Some might be looking for a place that they won't live in for a while. There really is a lot of diversity even among the kinds of real estate demand that we see from particular countries. But one of the clear patterns, in particular, particularly in searches from China, is they do tend to be concentrated in the West Coast in particularly expensive markets. That's one of the reasons why we see the dollar value of purchases by Chinese buyers higher than from other countries.
If you see a high dollar value and if you see that be concentrated, what does that mean then for the neighborhoods where a lot of that activity is happening. What happens to those neighborhoods?
Strong foreign demand can push up home prices, and especially the neighborhoods that do get a lot of Chinese interest are parts of the West where inventory is often pretty tight to begin with. You know, it's not like Palo Alto or Irvine is a cheap housing market with lots of homes available for sale. Often, foreign demand gets blamed for prices rising, but at least in the case of Chinese investors, they're looking at places that were expensive to begin with. You know, when we look at patterns of migration and where people move from outside the U.S. and within the U.S., home prices have an important effect. We tend to see that there's domestic migration moving within the country, often to more affordable housing markets. But when we look at where people from outside the U.S. come to in the U.S., it tends to be in more expensive markets. Those are markets that traditionally have attracted more immigrants, even though those domestic moves often are toward more affordable U.S. housing markets.
Jed Kolko, Chief Economist for Trulia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that brings us to the weekend number. 450,000. Some 450,000 Chinese students are studying abroad this year. That's according to Chinese education officials. And about half of them will do that in the United States. Many will stay put after their graduation. Coming up in the show, Puerto Rico looks like an island paradise, but it's an economic mess that might affect your mutual fund.
It's quite a questionable and perilous time for the Commonwealth. All of its problems have come home to roost.
That's just ahead on Marketplace Weekend from APM. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology.
Wouldn't you prefer a good game of chess?
This is Tech in Real Life.
Our guide to tech in real life is Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie. You and I are going to have a contest.
Okay, I got one.
All right, you got one.
I got
one.
That guy right
I
there with the
I got
that
girl over there. She's on her phone. She just made it across the street.
This lady's listening to music here, pink dress.
I think you're beating me. This guy's
listener.
Got a phone.
That guy's
He's
phone.
Got a phone
Definitely
and a cigarette.
Phone. That guy on a bike on a phone.
On a
with
bike
the headphones
on a phone.
Well, let's talk about the reason that we're here. Why are we talking about people on their phones and all of these random New Yorkers?
Okay, so as you can guess, using your device while you're traveling, whether you're riding your bike, walking the streets, driving a car, is a huge issue. It's a growing issue. It's a growing cause of accidents, all sorts of things. So the city is working on this thing. They're trying to get to zero pedestrian deaths in the city per year. It's called Vision Zero. It's a project between the Department of Transportation and the mayor's office. They're trying to improve safety at 50 intersections every year. We're at 3rd Avenue right now. They're working on some of these uptown, downtown avenues to do so. They're doing things like adding in extra crosswalks. They're extending the sidewalk section on corners so that crosswalks are actually shorter. They're trying to create, and there goes a bus right now, sort of more obvious delineation between bus lanes, bike lanes, driving lanes. That's part of it, but also AT&T launched a program this summer in New York called Connected Intersections. It's basically a contest. They are delivering about $50,000 in contest money to developers in the city who are designing ways to use people's devices to help them be more aware of their surroundings, which is an interesting idea, right?
This isn't just about New York and New Yorkers, though. This is happening in a lot of other places or similar ideas.
Yeah, it's happening all over the place. Now, for instance, there's a company called Mobile Eye that's actually using your smartphone as a dashboard-mounted device, and it's using your car and your phone to detect pedestrians and try and give you early warnings about pedestrians who are on the street or might be on the street up in front of you. In Australia, there's a company called Traffic Tech that's actually building pedestrian pads, really thin pedestrian pads that detect when someone is walking on them. And of course, this pad will actually communicate with the traffic lights to tell it when pedestrians are off the street, when they're on the street. There's another company in Belgium that's doing the same thing, but traffic light based. So it's from the traffic light, is trying to detect pedestrians and change lights according to pedestrians. Now, you've experienced that in a car, right? But this is the opposite thing.
How do you make sure that these tech solutions designed to make you a more aware pedestrian don't just make you more aware of your phone?
Yes, this is a big question, right? And it's a big problem for developers. No matter what, I don't know if you've heard about, I think they call it text neck, this thing that people get. They get sore necks from looking down all the time and texting. If you're interacting with your device, you're not interacting with the environment around you. This is an issue. But there are ways in which actually people's devices can warn vehicles. There's actually a project that Nissan is doing where it's triangulating between pedestrians' phones, GPS, and your vehicle to tell you when people are getting in your way and or might be in your way in the future. And phones might deliver you warnings when you're starting to cross the street. It might beep at you or something if you're starting to cross the street that you shouldn't be crossing at that time. Things like that, but it's a huge problem.
Spin it forward for me. What's this intersection going to look like in a couple of years? How is this going to be different?
What we can imagine is in different cities, they're going to be trying these kinds of technologies. Companies are going to be trying them. Municipalities are going to be trying them. As this problem becomes more and more obvious and more pronounced, all sorts of organizations are going to try and fix it. So I think what that means in the near term is an explosion of options for trying to improve transportation, trying to improve people's awareness as they interact with their devices. In the far term, hopefully what we'll see is some of these things will be successful. Some of them will be a mess. The ones that are a mess will fail. The ones that are successful will result in some form of, I guess, uniformity as you're traveling around in a particular country from town to town. You might see some of the same stuff, and it might have some of the same kinds of technology embedded in it to hopefully help protect you from yourself.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
We've got another story about unintended consequences now. The unintended consequences of investing in what were once thought to be very safe bonds issued by Puerto Rico. So safe that your mutual fund or 401k may in fact own them. Despite just balancing its budget for the first time in a decade, Puerto Rico is in rough financial shape. Our next guest even compares it to Detroit. His name is David Towle, and he's the co-founder of the firm Maglin Capital. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
My pleasure, Lizzie. Thank you.
If you're a regular person, maybe you've got a 401k, maybe a mutual fund, why do you care about what's happening to Puerto Rico's bonds, to their ability to pay their bills?
There is roughly $70 billion of outstanding debt coming from the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico. It is one of the top five largest issuers of municipal debt in the entire United States, and it is probably the most widely held municipal debt in all of the United States because the United States government has allowed for a very long time Puerto Rico to issue its debt on a triple tax-free basis. And so therefore, that triple tax-free status has led to a lot of appetite and desire, and so lots and lots of municipal mutual funds own at least some Puerto Rican debt. Some own a lot of Puerto Rico's debt.
So they thought, hey, I can get a pretty good return here for whatever plan this is. I can buy some of this and I can get some money for whatever mutual fund it is.
For sure. And so if you have a 401k and you're ticking off the box that says, I am not looking for anything particularly exciting in my return profile and I want stability and maybe a little bit of cash flow, you may very well be invested in some Puerto Rican debt on a derivative basis through a mutual fund that you own.
Right now, that feels like a great big oops.
It is. It's quite a questionable and perilous time for the Commonwealth. All of its problems have come home to roost. They have been in a recession for quite a long time. They have a very high unemployment rate. The percentage of working age people that actually work for the government as opposed to being in private enterprise is extremely high. They have extremely high power rates. They have a pension issue. So all of those things together have been very challenging. And anyone born on Puerto Rico, on the island, is a naturally born U.S. citizen. So if you're looking at a situation where there isn't as much promise, you're a person of, you know, a considerable amount of talent, you can easily go ahead and migrate to the mainland. And so therefore, that has been happening as well, where what is left on the island of Puerto Rico are really people that are almost forced to stay. They really can't leave.
We're talking about a brain drain.
Yes.
So Puerto Rico has a very high murder rate, about six times the national average. A lot of drugs that flow through Mexico sometimes go through Puerto Rico en route to the U.S. Do you think that makes investors nervous?
I think it certainly makes them pause. But at the same time, remember, it is a Commonwealth of the United States. And so at this point, it seems clear that the government of Puerto Rico, the officials, are going to need Washington's help, not necessarily for a check, but definitely around a bunch of different things, maybe to go ahead and protect its borders, maybe to go ahead and increase drug enforcement, and so forth.
So how does Puerto Rico climb out of this hole?
I think it can. So let me just, I alluded earlier to Detroit. So we didn't talk
about— That's a tough comparison.
That is a tough comparison, and people have tried to make that comparison. I think Detroit is in a much more difficult place than Puerto Rico. We in the restructuring industry like to talk about low-hanging fruit fairly often, which means that a new administration in this case, or a new management team in the case of a company, can go ahead and come in and do a lot of easy fixes in order to turn things around. In the case of Puerto Rico, there is a lot of low-hanging fruit. I don't think you can say the same for Detroit. First of all, because of its climate, it will always be a good tourism destination. The second thing is it has tax attributes that for an individual that aren't prevalent throughout the United States. And a number of very wealthy, ultra high net worth individuals have been associated recently with Puerto Rico on an individual basis. And in addition, the pension obligations are quite overbloated. They can be reformed and cut. The taxes can be raised, and they can and will do that. It will take a considerable period of time. One thing I must say explicitly, I believe in the long-term turnaround of Puerto Rico, but in contrast to most restructurings that we're accustomed to with respect to corporations, this is a different animal. It's going to take a decade plus to turn this ship around.
David Tell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Lizzie. I appreciate it.
We talk a lot about the effects of the economy on millennials, student loans, high unemployment rates. But even when they do have money, millennials are reluctant to invest it. Turns out that's an unexpected consequence of graduating right in the middle of a recession. Reporter Dan Bobkoff talked about it earlier this week, and the story really took off with our community on Facebook and on Twitter. So we asked Dan to come on and tell us a little bit more. Hi, Dan. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Thank you.
Lay this out for me. What's going on with millennials and their money?
Well, millennials, most people say, were born around, you know, early 80s to late 80s. And the problem is, you know, they're the youngest investing part of the population, which means they have the most years for their money to grow. But for many of them, when they were younger, they saw the dot-com bust. And when they were graduating college, or at least a little bit older, they saw the big crash in 08. So they're a little bit scared of the market. They don't believe it necessarily works for them. They don't think it is rigged in their favor. So we're finding that by quite large margins, 3-to-1 margins, millennials say they'd rather just put whatever savings they have into a old stodgy savings account.
Which is fascinating because, of course, this is the age, if you think about compound interest, that you have the most to gain from your money if you're thinking about sort of investing for the long term.
Right. If you ever read those financial advice columns, you see that all these things, like if you start investing in your 20s and stop at 35, you have more money than if you start at 35 and invest for the rest of your career. So in terms of compounding interest, in terms of having the ability to make up for a loss, if there is another crash down the line, now is the time to start if you're in your 20s. And yet, because they're afraid of the market, many of them are putting it into savings accounts, which are paying maybe at best 0.8%, and many of them are more like 0.01%, which if we have inflation of, say, 2, 3%, it's actually losing money. People don't realize that even though it feels safe, over time they're losing money to inflation.
When you reported this story and you talked to experts, what did they tell you about why this was happening, or even when you talked to millennials?
That's right. I mean, I think there is, I don't want to go too far, but I think there's almost a little bit of fatalism that it's hard to get good jobs. It's hard to get good jobs with benefits. It's, you know, you're lucky to save enough for retirement, period. And I think a lot of people are afraid that maybe Social Security won't be there, that their 401ks won't get big enough. And, you know, some experts I've talked to in the past say that maybe that's okay. Maybe we should just, you know, get our lives together. It takes so long to get your lives together now that maybe it takes till age 40 to figure it out with a house and kids, whereas maybe luckier older generations are able to do it more quickly. But I do think there's also this unnecessary fear that because they saw what happened in 08, they're just staying away from the market. And that means that they're missing out on the one investment that, at least in the past, has outpaced inflation consistently. And that is a problem when it is so important that we save enough either for a house or for retirement when we don't have pensions and we don't have the security of past generations.
I have to ask you, you're, I guess, technically a millennial. You're at the high end, right? 31?
I'm at the old age of millennials, yes.
Yeah, whatever, man. I'm Generation X. So
you're the cynical one, then.
Yeah, I'm the cynical one. Are you saving? Does this apply to you?
I am saving. And, you know, I'm old enough that I started my career before the recession in 08. And I remember when I got my first job at a very low salary, just trying to put a little bit away in a savings account. But back then, I could get an online savings account paying something like 4.25%, which is not bad. I mean, that's, you know, some stocks don't do that well. Nowadays, as I said, I mean, you get, you know, 0.5, 0.75%. And that's not going to cut it long term. So I have been pretty aggressive with any money I have beyond a retirement account because, you know, I did read those advice columns about compounding interest and try to at least have a chance at a decent retirement. But I talked to my friends and many of them don't seem interested in the market, or they're just not thinking about it because maybe they haven't even gotten their careers to a point where they have anything left over from after 6 months of savings.
Your piece got a lot of interest online, and I have questions from folks on social media and email. One of them was, how many folks under 30 have enough safe emergency savings that they can even begin to invest? It sounds like this person was saying that they're doing exactly what they need to, that people are being cautious. I mean, I guess there's an argument that if you don't have the money, don't risk it in the market.
This was the frustrating thing for me reporting this because there's very little data that breaks out millennials on how much they're making and how much they have in assets to begin with. So we don't know if there's a big disparity between those who come from money and those who are struggling. You know, you could have two people in nonprofit jobs earning 40 grand, but you know, their means and what they need for the future could be very different. So, and I think having come through the recession, I remember advice columns saying, you know, have 3 months of savings before the recession. Now they often advise 6, 12 months. That takes a long time to save that much money when you're in your 20s and you're just paying rent and you're maybe paying your own health insurance. So I think for many of them, it's not even an option to even think about aggressive investments.
Anything that really surprised you when you were reporting this piece?
I did talk to someone who hadn't really thought much about money or savings in her 20s. And she went the other extreme and is actually becoming a financial planner. So I do wonder how much of this is just sort of normal 20-somethings not really thinking beyond the next week or the next year. And eventually, as they get older, they start paying more attention.
What are you working on next? Tell us, give us a little peek in your notebook.
I'm doing a story about the online dating industry.
Ooh.
And I was surprised to learn how many different brands are controlled by the same parent company. Companies that you think are competitors, Match, OkCupid, Tinder, and now How About We are all owned by Interactive Corp, as it's called, which is the Barry Diller investment company that also owns a lot of companies like Vimeo and College Humor. And I'm interested, I'm sort of exploring their strategy of keeping these sites separate and how much, if there's any room there for synergies and how they can learn from each other. and how these sites attract different demographics, but also this interplay of you need to have a big enough pool for them to be useful, but people kind of self-identify as, you know, belonging on one place versus another.
That's fascinating.
Stay tuned.
Dan Bobkoff, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's it. That's Marketplace Weekend for this week. Next time, we'll have some brunch and explore how you make childcare work for your family. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan and John Sepulvedo. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Charlton Thorpe is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and we'll see you next weekend. This is APM.